Thank you for listening to this week's sermon podcast by Dr. John Hanna. It is our hope and prayer that you will be encouraged in your faith and in your walk with Jesus. For more information, please go to springfieldchurch.org. Here now is the most recent message.
Mark chapter 1, beginning at verse 29. And let's listen again to the words of the gospel and their implications for us as God's children. As soon as they left the synagogue, they went with James and John to the home of Simon and Andrew. Simon's mother-in-law was in bed with a fever, and they told Jesus about her. So he went to her, took her hand, and helped her up. The fever left her, and she began to wait on them. That evening, after sunset, the people brought to Jesus all the sick and demon-possessed. The whole town gathered at the door, and Jesus healed many who had various diseases. He also drove out many demons, but he would not let the demons speak because they knew who he was. Very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. Simon and his companions went to look for him. And when they found him, they exclaimed, "Everyone is looking for you." Jesus replied, "Let us go somewhere else, to the nearby villages, so I can preach there also. That is why I have come." So he traveled throughout Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and driving out demons. A man with leprosy came to him and begged him on his knees, "If you are willing, you can make me clean." Filled with compassion, Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. "I am willing," he said, "be clean." Immediately the leprosy left him, and he was cured. Jesus sent him away at once with a strong warning, "See that you don't tell this to anyone, but go show yourselves to the priest and offer the sacrifices that Moses commanded for your cleansing as a testimony to them." Instead, he went out and began to talk freely, spreading the news. As a result, Jesus could no longer enter a town openly, but stayed outside in lonely places. Yet the people still came to him from everywhere. These four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are universal in their scope, in that here we are 2,000 years later after they have been composed, and they still speak to us today. And so it speaks to the universality of the power of the scope of the gospel, how millions and billions of people for 2,000 years would hear the gospel or read the gospel and be inspired by who Jesus is. And so there is a universal scope to these gospels and to the gospel of Mark. But we have to understand that they were written in a very contextualized setting. Things were happening as Mark wrote his gospel. The gospel of Mark just didn't appear in a vacuum. There were things happening all around which influenced and informed Mark and the way he composed and wrote this gospel. I'm sorry if you're not a history buff, but we need to do some history today, because it will help us understand to a greater degree how and why Mark composed this first gospel. The Gospel of Mark was written sometime between 60 and 70 AD. Why is this important? This is incredibly important because the Roman emperor at the time was the dreaded Emperor Nero. Nero oversaw the mighty and powerful Roman Empire at this time, under which Jesus and all the other people in the New Testament were subjects to the Roman Empire. Nero was the fifth emperor of Rome, and one of, if not Rome's most infamous, sadistic, notorious, use any other adjective you want to use, crazy emperor in Rome's history. He began his rule when he was around 16 or 17 years old, and then he had himself killed at the age of 30 when Roman senators decided Nero needed to go, and he saw the writing on the wall. Nero had issues. He is infamous for orchestrating the murder of his own mother, Agrippa the Younger, after having incestuous relations with her, of course. Nero was known for forcing his perceived enemies and rivals to commit suicide. This included his former mentor, the philosopher Seneca, and his own wife, Octavia. His second wife, Pompeia Sabina, Nero beat and kicked to death while she was pregnant with their child, and they both died. He then married a young boy named Sporus, whom he had castrated. Nero had his stepbrother Britannicus poisoned. Nero was a wannabe artist who had artistic aspirations and would often force other subjects to listen to his poetry and his musical performances. And guess what? If they didn't like what they heard, off with their heads. Nero's love for brutal entertainment was very well known. He reportedly enjoyed watching the gruesome execution of criminals and perceived enemies. He was a spender. He loved to spend enormous amounts of money on himself, his personal projects. He would lavish money upon himself, like his golden palace, the Domus Aurora, which included, of course, a colossal statue of himself, about 100 feet tall. But what that did was drain the Roman treasury, which led to severe economic strain among the people. Now, in order to build this lavish palace, which historians tell us was anywhere from 100 to 300 acres, he needed to clear land and basically rebuild Rome in his image. So, surprise, surprise, a suspicious fire broke out in Rome in July of AD 64, known as the Great Fire of Rome. Rome burned for 6 days out of control, and it was completely devastating. 6 days after the fire was somewhat under control, surprise, surprise, more fires started to crop up throughout the city. 71% of Rome was completely destroyed, 10 out of their 14 districts. Nero blamed the Christians for the fire, and he started the first wide-scale persecution of Christians. One of those Christians was the Apostle Peter, who was in Rome at the time of his death. If you've been to the Vatican, St. Peter's Square is at the very heart of the Vatican in Rome. And that's where tradition holds that that is the spot where Peter was crucified upside down under Nero's persecution. Nero would take other Christians and have them crucified and then light them on fire so that he could see his garden at night. Watch this short video.
Nero was born on the 15th of December 37 AD in Antium, near Rome. He was the only son of Gnaeus, a cruel consul of Rome, and his wife Agrippina the Younger, sister of another infamous emperor, Caligula. When Nero's father was congratulated on having his son, he reportedly said that nothing produced by me and Agrippina could possibly be good for the state or the people. Taking the throne at only 17 years of age, Nero's domineering mother, Agrippina, attempted to control her son and influence his decisions as emperor. Eventually, however, Nero began to reject his mother's advice, which prompted her to attempt to turn the public opinion against him. In an attempt to secure his hold on the throne, Nero killed his stepbrother Britannicus and banished his mother from his palace. In 59 AD, fed up with her interference, Nero had his mother killed. Nero divorced and banished his first wife, Octavia, his stepsister, on grounds of infertility and adultery, later having her executed. He then married Sabina in 62 AD, and the couple had a daughter who died in infancy. Sabina then died in 65 AD, reportedly due to Nero violently beating and kicking his wife in her stomach during her second pregnancy. He then married Statilia Messalina after forcing her husband to commit suicide. Following the Great Fire of Rome, which caused widespread devastation, before being brought under control after 6 days in July 64 AD, Nero blamed members of the Christian religion for the fire. He ordered swift persecutions. Some were condemned to be dressed in animal skins and torn apart by dogs. Others were crucified, and some were even lined up and burnt alive to provide light within the emperor's gardens. In the aftermath of the fire, rumors quickly began to spread regarding this cause. As one popular account goes, Nero had been planning to construct his grand palace, but needed to clear a large enough area to accommodate the complex. So he arranged for the fire to break out in order to clear the aristocratic dwellings on the slopes of Palatine Hill, and gleefully fiddled as he watched the fire encompass Rome. The truth to this claim, however, remains contested. So, with many citizens in desperate need of aid, Nero exhausted the Roman treasury, rebuilding the city around his 100-acre palace complex. At its center, he commissioned a 100-foot-tall bronze statue of himself. Reportedly, people in the palace would eat until they vomited, and then couple for massive sex parties, while rose petals fell on them from above. In 67 AD, Nero fell in love with a young man named Sporus. He then ordered him to be castrated and married him. Noted by the historian Cassius Dio, this was because Sporus bore an uncanny resemblance to Nero's dead former wife, Sabina.
Nero had some issues, didn't he? You think your family has problems. It's no wonder then, as we understand the background from which Mark wrote this gospel, that Nero was obviously despised and feared, and even some considered him to be the Antichrist. Now, Mark was a companion, interpreter, scribe for the Apostle Peter, and he could have very well witnessed Peter's crucifixion in Rome before he went to Alexandria, Egypt. If he was already in Egypt at the time, he most certainly would have heard about what happened to Peter in Rome. Earlier in Mark's gospel, Mark chapter 1, verse 15, Mark uses kingdom language. He says, in quoting Jesus, the first recorded words of Jesus, "The time has come, the kingdom of God is near." Kingdom language. And immediately the people back then would have equated such political language with what was happening under Roman tyranny. We can't escape politics, even today. However much we want to try, stick our fingers in our ears and go, no, I don't want to hear about politics, nope. Politics affects us every day. The decisions our politicians make affect our economy. The decisions our politicians make affect our loved ones who are in the military service. It goes on and on and on. So we can't divorce what's happening in our culture today from politics. And the same was certainly true back then. So Jesus comes on the scene, and in Mark chapter 1, he begins to use kingdom language, which invokes political feelings. And Jesus says, the kingdom, but it's a different kingdom. It's a heavenly kingdom. It's not the earthly kingdom. The kingdom of God is at hand. Jesus is saying, there's a new kingdom now, and there's a new king on the scene. And the contrast between God's kingdom and the new king who's ushering in God's kingdom and the emperor Nero could not be more different. Nero's empire was marked by these following characteristics. The means by which he maintained power and control were marked by evil, vengeance, betrayal, debauchery, brutality, and persecution. If you want to be a Roman emperor, you want to have control and power over your region, this is what you do. And Nero was very good at it, and that's exactly what he did. These were the means by which Rome dominated. And then we read in Mark chapter 1, this new kingdom being ushered in by a new king, and in contrast, in very stark contrast, as we read in the rest of Mark chapter 1, God's kingdom will be marked by the following, and these are the means by which God's kingdom will reign. God's kingdom will be known for compassion, healing, restoration, deliverance, prayer, preaching, and cleansing. Look at Mark chapter 1, verses 29, 30, and 31. As soon as they left the synagogue, they went with James and John to the home of Simon and Andrew. Simon's mother-in-law was in bed with a fever, and they told Jesus about her. Now look very closely at verse 31. Look at the tender compassion Jesus had on this woman. He went to her, he took her hand, and he helped her up. The picture I see there is one of a very caring, compassionate Jesus. And of course, he healed her. Jesus, this new king, God's kingdom, is marked by genuine, heartfelt compassion. We read all throughout the Gospels that one of the primary characteristics of Jesus was his compassion. Remember when he was teaching and there were large crowds in Matthew 14 and 15? The gospel writers tell us that Jesus was moved with compassion for the people. What a contrast to Nero, who could have cared less about anybody. But God's kingdom, this new king, is marked by compassion. Look at Mark 1:32. That evening after sunset, the people brought to Jesus the sick and demon-possessed. The whole town gathered at the door, and Jesus healed many who had various diseases. This new kingdom of God is marked by healing. And of course, you just read through the Gospels, and Jesus healed one right after the other. Whereas Nero brought about destruction and mayhem and hurt and pain and suffering, Jesus, God's kingdom, is marked by healing. I came across this poem by Steve Garness Holmes. He's a retired United Methodist minister, and he wrote this beautiful poem about Jesus the healer. Jesus, my healer, come to me and touch me. Lay your hand upon my soul. All my woundedness gently embrace and bless. And though I'm broken, make me whole. Source of our healing, God our recreator, your deep joy is to raise and bless. Your faithful promise and all our trusting hopes are stronger than our dark distress. Spirit of healing, move among your people and bless as you flow upon us with tender love to bless the world's brokenness and share the grace that makes us new. God's kingdom is marked by healing as Jesus went around and healed. Another powerful mark of God's kingdom, ushered in by Jesus the King, is restoration. In healing and driving out demons, Jesus was restoring people to their rightful place. Whereas Nero just tore people apart, Jesus was all about restoration. Turn to Luke chapter 19, verse 10 with me. Luke here has a powerful sentence here that speaks of the restoration of Jesus. Luke 19:10. For the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. Beautiful mark of the restoration, the means by which the kingdom of God moves and operates. God seeks to restore. Whereas the kingdoms of this world seek to destroy, God's kingdom is vastly different. Look at Mark 1:34. We read again of the power of Jesus over the demonic. He drove out many demons, but he would not let the demons speak because they knew who he was. You see, Nero was demon-possessed. He flaunted his demons. He perpetrated the demonic. Jesus came to set people free. In John's Gospel, we read that the ministry of Jesus was to speak the truth so that the truth would set people free. Jesus and the kingdom of God is marked by deliverance from the demonic oppressions of this world. In Mark 1:35, we read very clearly that Jesus would often go away to a solitary place and do what? Pray. Whereas Nero praised himself and sought the praise of others to the point of suppressing them if they didn't, Jesus humbled himself and his ministry was marked by prayer. We read this all throughout the Gospels. Even at the very end of his life, at the Garden of Gethsemane, we find Jesus praying. And so the kingdom of God is marked by prayer. A deep searching for the heart of God to give us the power we need to overcome. Another powerful mark of the inbreaking of God's kingdom is the preaching ministry of Jesus. You see, whenever Nero made a decree, people cringed because they knew bad things were going to happen. But when Jesus preached, lives were changed, people turned to God, and goodness flowed. In Mark 1:38, Jesus says, I have to go preach. That's why I've come. And earlier in Mark's gospel, and in Mark 1:14, we understand that his preaching was a proclamation of good news. Good news. God's kingdom is the alternative to the systematic evils of this world. And so Jesus proclaimed good news and offered eternal hope. In Mark 1:40, we read this incredible story of this leper who went to Jesus and said, make me clean. Make me clean. And of course, we know that Jesus, by his power, cleansed this leper. You see, Nero made people feel dirty. He used them and abused them. That's what this world does. But Jesus offers cleansing and makes us whole. These are the means by which God's kingdom will rule and reign forever. You see, Jesus waged war, but it was a different kind of war. Jesus had an army, but his army were disciples who he taught and mentored and empowered to do what he did. And Jesus had his own weapons, but they were not weapons of this world. They were weapons of prayer and preaching and healing and cleansing. In 2 Corinthians 10:4, we read this powerful verse from the Apostle Paul. He says, "The weapons we fight with are not the weapons of this world." Now, the world says to us, if you want to get anywhere, you want to be successful, you want power, you want to rise to the top, you need to follow Nero's plan for success. Nero's means to dominance and power and success. And people today still follow that blueprint. If you want to make it, do what Nero did. Do what the systems of this world does. But Jesus says, in very stark contrast, and the Roman Empire and the systems of this world, Jesus very clearly says, follow me and my ways, and guess which one will last longer. You see, here we are 2,000 years later. I've not met one person in my life who says, I worship Nero. I belong to the first church of Nero. I've not met anyone who thinks Nero was a good man. But here we are 2,000 years later with the inbreaking of God's kingdom, and there are an estimated 2.2 billion Christians worldwide who worship Jesus that make up about 31% of the world's population. The weapons and the means by which Jesus used are countercultural to the world's domination. One would think, as Nero, the pharaohs, other dictators, other rulers, even that mean boss you work for, one would think that the ways of this world will achieve what you want to achieve. And in the short term, it works. You can bully someone and get your way. In the long term, it falls flat on its face. When the scriptures say, love endures forever, it's truthful. Because the means of God in His kingdom and the power of love will do more and last longer than the ways of this broken, evil world. Jesus says, follow me and my ways, for love, not evil, not vengeance, not betrayal, not debauchery, not brutality, not persecution, but love endures forever.
Hi, I'm John Hanna, pastor of All Things Good, a church that believes in the goodness of God because God is the source of all things good. We are located on the corner of 18th and East Street in Springfield, and our Sunday morning service is 11 o'clock a.m. For more information about our church, you can visit our website at springfieldchurch.org. We look forward to meeting you, and I hope you have a great day.